Okay, so we have the privilege of being able to start the topic of Melachos Shabbos from the very beginning, and from the very beginning of the Masechta. And that's a special opportunity, because normally, if one wants to start the Melachos of Shabbos one by one, so it's popular to start from Ayin Gimel, from the Mishnah which lists all the Melachos, and we've done that in the past. And that definitely is an approach, but there's a strong value to starting from here as well. Starting from Beis Amud Aleph, from where Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi decided to start the Melachos of Shabbos, there is a lot to be gleaned from trying to understand the Melacha of Hotzah, which in many ways, as we'll see, is a unique Melacha. And the placement at the beginning of the Masechta is worth talking about. It might give us some insight into Melachos as a whole. As you know, the Rishonim very often discuss at the beginning of a Masechta why a Masechta starts where it does, why is the first Mishnah the first Mishnah, and this Masechta is no exception. And Tosfos and other Rishonim talk about that question: why is this the first Mishnah of Shabbos? Maybe Ayin Gimel would have been a better first Mishnah for Shabbos, listing all the Malachas. So Tosfos brings up this issue, and I think the question probably could be approached from a number of angles, but it may prove to be very helpful to us trying to understand this sukkah specifically as far as understanding all the malachas in general. So I'm a big believer that there's a lumdish significance also. We saw that last year with Bav Metziah too. The way the Masechta starts sometimes lays down foundations for the rest of the Masechta in ways that are not always obvious. And I think that's true here also. The question of why Hotzah starts off our Masechta may be somewhat of a Pesach, somewhat of a gateway into the concept of the Melachos in general. So in order to address that, I'd like to recap a little bit an introduction to the Melachos that we mentioned at the beginning of the year, because that introduction is relevant very specifically to Hotzah. Understanding Hotzah requires us to understand how it fits into the structure of the Melachos as a whole, and therefore it gives us an opportunity to look at the two together. Just off the bat, what's unique about how Hotzah is presented to us, how Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi taught us about Hotzah, what's unusual about it? There's a couple of things that are unusual, Shmuley.
It's Yis as opposed to Hotzahs.
Okay, I'm not sure if that necessarily, just in terms of the grammar, that's necessarily significant, maybe. But what else in terms of placement and in terms of structure? So there's two points which somewhat are at odds with each other. And then on the one hand, yes?
Deraisis and Derabanans.
Deraisis and Derabanans in terms of Hotzah being, including some both, Okay, perhaps, that's also interesting. That's also something to talk about. Right? And Tosfos focuses on the fact that there's so many different dinim that are all placed together in this Mishnah. But what's also interesting is, do you see a contrast between the Mishnah on Ayin Gimel and the Mishnah on Daf Beis? Or to put it a little bit more starkly, not so much a contrast between the Mishnah on Ayin Gimel and Mishnah on Daf Beis, but the Mishnah being on Daf Beis.
Why starting
here? Right, so the question of why we start with Hotzah is made a little bit more powerful by looking at the Mishnah on Ayin Gimel. Right, what is there in the Mishnah in Ayin Gimel which gives us even more reason not to start with Hotzah? It's the last one. Right? So we open the Masechta with Hotzah, and when we list the Melachos by themselves, so not only is Hotzah not the first, but Hotzah is the last. Now, is that surprising that it's the last? Would you have thought that it should have been somewhere in the middle? Is there any reason why Hotzah should be last?
Yeah, is the nature of the Melacha is going to be so different.
So is that being hinted at that Mishnah? You think the Mishnah is basically saying that there's 38 Melachas that are the same, and there's one Melacha that's different, so we'll mention that last?
I mean, it could be that there's a theme. I mean, those are all in groups, but Hotzah seems to be something that's relevant to everything. It's also something that could be in that Mishnah, or just its source. I mean, there could be something that's...
So the group's point is an interesting point. I'll mention, I'll take your question in a second, but what Yos is pointing out is, so for example, the first 11 Melachos of Shabbos are known as Sidur of the Pas. And that there is something that links all those first 11 Masechtas, and in general, So the malachos seem to have somewhat of a structure that malachos that are related to each other are grouped to each other. So if that's the case, maybe Hotzah just doesn't have any connection to anything else, and therefore we're able to group all the other malachos and the Mishnah lists it like that, and then Hotzah is the odd man out, and that ends up at the end. So I think Chaim was up first.
I mean, there are many cases where we kind of put the list at the beginning of the Masechta. Why isn't the list of Ma'an Gimel at the beginning of the Masechta?
Right, so that itself is a question, right? So that's one of the issues that it would have seemed a logical place to start with the whole list, but also that the list is here, and that Hotzah, which does start the Masechta, is at the end of the list. That seems to be two opposite directions. All right?
Just talking about the groups thing, even if it's Amin out, you can still place it as the first one.
So if it should have been the first, like it's the first Mishnah, so it should be the first here. Right? Unless, maybe all 38 also have something in common that Hotzah is left out of. So Hotzah gets some interesting attention here. It gets maybe negative attention, positive attention. It's the beginning of the Masechta. It's the end of the list. Somehow it is set aside as different from the other malachas. Yes, you're going
to first. It might also be considered like a hypersensitive malacha in contrast to the other one, in the sense that I think it's supposed to break down the strangeness of how the malacha is performed. You can carry a needle from 2 feet this way and carry a couch up and down flights and stairs. And
that's where'd you see that? You saw that?
Yeah.
The first Tosfos.
Or the Rashba, the Ramban. Right, because the Tosfos focuses on something different, but it might be related. But we have to try to address those ideas a little bit. The Rishonim do talk about that.
And there could be a reason why over there. It's also just because it's how you transgress it is just different.
So you say hypersensitive. So do you mean that the threshold is lower, or that it's just really hard to pin down? Because it seems to be when you say hypersensitive, the impression you get is that you could violate it more easily than the other malachas, which might be true. But that point that the Rishonim talk about, that it's strange that I could carry a piece of paper outside and violate a malacha, while I could carry a couch from one side of the room to the next and not violate a malacha. So that seems to say that it's just hard to understand in general. It doesn't go in any understandable direction, because the nature of the malacha doesn't seem to correlate at all to what we would think is more of a disruption of our Shabbos. So we already clued into this fact that Hotzah has got something unique about it. And as we'll see, so the Rishonim give a name to that. The Rishonim give a somewhat of a insulting name, I guess. Nowadays, it wouldn't really fly in today's culture. It gives such a disparaging name. But the Rishonim call Hotzah essentially an inferior malacha, a malacha grua. So that language is in Tosfos in a number of places. Some of the Rishonim have it in different language, but they're getting at the same idea. In some cases, you'll see, if you get to see all the Maamar Kamos tomorrow, or most of them, so you'll see some of the Rishonim say it in a softer way, and some say it in a stronger way, but they all seem to be addressing the same idea, that some of the Rishonim will say that Hotzah is a Chiddush, which seems to be a softer way of saying it. It's a surprising malacha. And some will go so far as to use language like ain't a malacha. It's not really a malacha, but clearly it is. So it's a non-malacha that somehow got on the list. So there's a lot to try to figure out about how exactly Hotzah fits in, and what exactly the Rishonim are getting at with their malacha gerua assumption, and what does that mean? What's the significance? It's a major topic that we'll have to figure out. But first, we have to try to understand what malacha is in general. So we had a little bit of an introduction to this in the beginning of last month. I just want to recap some of the key points, because it'll become especially relevant to trying to understand this malacha, and therefore each will impact on the other. Hotzah will give us somewhat of a perspective on all the other malachas at the same time. So a point that we emphasized last semester at the beginning has to do with how the malachas are presented in the Torah, and what the isser of a malacha is. That we know there is an unusual structure in terms of the relationship between Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebapeh. That there are 39 malachas of Shabbos, but the Torah doesn't tell us that at all. The Torah doesn't tell us what they are, or how many there are. And Chazal are left with a very heavy job of trying to spell out all the important details that the Torah B'chsav doesn't tell us. And the Mishnah in Chagiga and Daf Yud kind of emphasizes how striking that is. The Mishnah says that Hilcha Shabbos Kaharim Hatzluyim B'sairos, that the laws of Shabbos are like mountains that are hanging from hairs, that are hanging from strings, that there's so much in terms of the detail and the substance and the importance of Hilcha Shabbos. And as far as the Torah is not telling us too much at all. The Torah is giving us very little to hang those mountains on. And then when the Gemara addresses that Mishnah a little bit more, the Gemara in Chagiga, so it focuses specifically on the fact of Malachas Machshavis, the idea of Malachas Machshavis, which is kind of a slogan in Hilcha Shabbos, that we know that all the Malachas have to meet a standard of Malachas Machshavis, however you translate that, that's itself a discussion. But that's a factor that keeps coming up in Hilcha Shabbos. It's such an important element. And where is that in the Torah? Not in the context of Shabbos. It's in the context of the Mishkan. And because we learn out the laws of Shabbos from the laws of the Mishkan, so we have to look to the Mishkan for everything. We have to look to the Mishkan for what the Malachas are. And we have to look to the Mishkan for the whole concept of Malachas Machshavos, which is such a fundamental element. It's such a key factor in Hilcha Shabbos. We don't even know about it from the Torah talking about Shabbos, we only know about it from the Mishkan. So the relationship of Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh here is very unusual. So we have an understanding that we do derive all the Malachas from the Mishkan. It's a little bit of a machlokus in the Gemara about this, and the Rishonim essentially say, and I'm saying this all in a very abbreviated form, the Rishonim essentially say that everyone agrees that we look to the Mishkan for the Malachas. The question that the Gemara has a machlokus about is, do we look to the Mishkan to find out that there are 39 malachos and what they are? Or do we have some other source that there are 39 malachos and we look to the Mishkan to find out what those 39 are? And the Gemara has some possibilities that maybe is a gematria, maybe, and that's a very surprising possibility, Pnei Yeshua and others say it's hard to believe that's the real source because, as Rav Schechter is fond of noting, gematria is not a real midah shatar nidrashas behem. We don't really have halachos learned out from gematrias that make cute divrei Torah. Parparos l'chachma, as the Mishnah says, but they're not a real method for deriving anything. So it's unlikely that that's the real source. The Gemara talks about counting up different usages of the word malacha in the Torah to get the number of 39. It's all very striking because it's all a very roundabout way of defining the concept of malacha, of this central idea. And the notion that we learn the malachas from the Mishkan is itself a little bit vague. But what does it mean to say we learn the malachas from the Mishkan? So you'd probably say intuitively that it means that whatever was done in the construction of the Mishkan, which is a little bit easier for us to understand, that the malacha of the Mishkan was the ultimate creative act. And if we're not supposed to be creative on Shabbos, so then that which was done to the Mishkan should not be done on Shabbos. So that's perhaps a more intuitive understanding. But there are some Rishonim who maintain that it doesn't just limit itself to that which was done in the construction of the Mishkan, but whatever was done in the Mishkan at all, anything that's part of the Avodah, is considered to be a model for a Malacha, which gives a much broader terrain for Malachas to be learned from. So to give an example, the first 11 malachas we said before are called Sidura de Pas, which translates as the process of baking bread. All the first 11 malachas ending off in Bishul, our next topic, all have to do with baking bread. And baking bread was not a part of the construction of the Mishkan. So why should that be at all a part of the malachas? So Rashi says, you're right, it's not really a part of the malachas, it's essentially just an easy way to keep everything together. But really, the question goes to what this 11th malacha should be. Should it be Bishul or should it be Ofeh? So if you say that the malacha is called Ofeh, baking, so baking was not really a part of the construction of the Mishkan at all. So some of the Rishonim say it doesn't have to be a part of construction, it has to be involved with the Mishkan. So in the Mishkan, they had the Lechem Aponim, that was part of it. So therefore, baking bread is a malacha. Everything towards that is a malacha. But other Rishonim, like Rashi, say no, that the baking bread was not a model for the Malacha, because that was not part of the construction of the Mishkan. And really, Bishul was used in terms of making the dyes that were used for the various colors that were needed for the components of the Mishkan that had to have dyes. So they had to cook the elements, the ingredients to do that, the Bishul Samamanim, and according to Rashi and others, that's really what the model for that Malach is. So there is a debate as to what we mean when we're learning out from the Mishkan. So we're directed to the Mishkan to get all the Malachos, and that itself is a discussion, and we make a frequent reference to the Sefer Eglei Tal. Eglei Tal was written by the Tzachat Shover Rebbe, great Avnei Nezer. So he wrote the Sefer on the first 11 Malachas in the Siddur Depas. In his introduction, he has a whole discussion about this question, do we learn from the Mishkan, meaning the construction of the Mishkan, or the methods that were done in the Mishkan, the Avodas HaMishkan. And he asserts there that it's really a machlokus between the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi, and he has discussions about that. Alex?
If Bishul was a part of a dying, then wouldn't you assume that wouldn't be like a fundamental malacha, and it would just be like an extension of dying? Why would Rashi include that as...
The dying, applying the dye is one malacha, but making the dye is also a malacha. So the Bishul is in the manufacturing of the dye. And then using the dye to make colors is tovei, is another malacha. So just like Bishul itself, you have to have another 10 malachas before you get to Bishul. So it's all broken down into its component parts. So all of them count. So we have a very unclear path here in terms of figuring out the malachas. The Torah was really not so specific at all. And then we have one more concept, which is also an unusual method of communication. So for the most part, we don't really have malachas identified in the Torah. Right? The Torah doesn't spell out that we shouldn't write on Shabbos. There's no mention of writing. There's no mention of borer. There's no mention of cooking specifically. There's no mention of planting. The malachas are not named. There are really two exceptions. Maybe one exception or two exceptions. What are the exceptions?
Havara.
Sorry, that was one. So Havara. Havara is the explicit exception. And the other exception really is Hotzah. Right? So as we'll see, and we'll see more tomorrow with the other Marmakomos, that the Gemara does assume that there is a direct reference or more than one direct reference to Hotzah in the Torah. And that's an issue the Rishonim bring up. The Rishonim deal with why Hotzah seems to get spelled out, that Hotzah seems to require its own limud, and that that's somehow connected to the griasa, to the inferiority of the malacha, is somehow reflected in the fact that we need a source for Hotzah. We don't have a source for the other 38 malachas. Hotzah does have a source. That shows that it needs more help. That shows that there's something lacking in Hotzah that needs to have extra backing to it. But there is one other malacha that's identified, as Yosef said, and that is Havara. And in the case of Havara, it's not like Hotzah. There, the Gemara assumes that we have to explain why Havara is mentioned, but we don't take the attitude like the Rishonim take here, that, oh, Hotzah needs a limud. Right? Hotzah needs to be taught as a chiddush. That's what the Rishonim say here. We have to figure out why that is. Right? If we have 39 malachas, and 37 of them have no other source in the Torah, and Hotzah and Havara have sources, but they're approached differently. So the Rishonim say Hotzah gets a source, we have to figure out why it needs a source and the other malachas don't. In terms of Havara, so the Gemara doesn't assume that it's there to teach us about Havara. We assume that we know Havara. We would have figured out that Havara is one of the malachas. So the mention in Parshas Vayakel of Lo Sivaru Eish B'chol Moshon Seichem and B'yom HaShabbos is not there to teach us the malacha of Havara, it's there for something else. It's there to teach us a different lesson. So he asks the Gemara, Havara lama yatzos, why was Havara singled out if we know it already? So the Gemara has a couple possible answers, two possible answers. The Ramban has a different answer, different than the Gemara. The Ramban suggests that it's to tell us the difference between Yontif and Shabbos, that we know there are a few malachas that are permitted on Yontif for the purpose of Ochel Nefesh, and Havara happens to be one of them. So the Torah picks one malacha just to emphasize that that which is permitted on Yontif for Ochel Nefesh is not permitted on Shabbos. So Hotsa Havara is a good representation of that. So when the Torah says, Lo Sevaru Eish on Shabbos, it's telling us, don't think that that which you can do on Yontif for Ochel Nefesh, you're allowed to do on Shabbos. But the Gemara has other possibilities. Says the Gemara, either maybe it's there L'lav Yotzas, it's there to tell us that it's a lower level prohibition than the other malachas, which would be very surprising because the idea that setting a fire is a lower level malacha, and it's probably it's the anti-Hotzah in a sense, that this is one of the more intuitive malachas. Now Hotzah, if you out of all the 39 malachas, Havar is probably one that makes most sense. You see that you're really doing something when you set a fire. So that's not a malacha that's hard to relate to. So the idea that it's a lower level Isser would be very striking.
And it's just a lava now.
That's one of the possibilities of the Gemara. The Gemara says that maybe Havar Lalav Yatzas, it's singled out to tell us that it has a lower level possible significance. But we don't assume that way. We probably assume the other way. It's possible we don't assume either possibility, but we don't treat Havar as a lav. We treat it as a... And so it would be very significant because driving a car is mostly an issue of Havar. A lot of major malachas, a lot of major activities that we prohibit on Shabbos are a function of Havar. I mean, if it was a lav, it would still be usur, but the idea that it's less of a Avera on Shabbos and everything else would be a very striking idea. But, in any event, the other opinion in the Gemara is that Havara l'chalik yatzos. That Havara comes essentially as a representation. It sounds like it could have been any malacha. I'm not saying it's true, but it sounds like the pasuk could have used any malacha to make the point that there is a differentiation with all of the malachas. That even though the Torah does not list 39 malachas, the Torah does not identify 39 malachas. The Torah just tells us, one aveira, don't do malachas on Shabbos. But they are differentiated, and that's essentially what the Mishnah Ayin Gimel is telling us. Mishnah is telling us there's 39 different ways to be chayiv a korban on Shabbos. If somebody is going to do a malacha on Shabbos, so then he does it b'shogeg. Let's hope, at worst it happens b'shogeg. So then that is subject to a korban, that one has to bring a kapara for doing a chil Shabbos b'shogeg. So the chiddush of chiluk malachos is to say that we treat for that purpose, we treat the malachos as if they were independent of theirs. That at least for that purpose, and there's a whole discussion maybe for more purposes as well, maybe we'll come back to that subject a little bit, but at least on some level, chiluk malachos means that even though the Torah just tells us don't do malacha on Shabbos, it's as if the Torah had 39 psukim saying don't write on Shabbos, don't plant on Shabbos, don't plow on Shabbos, don't bake on Shabbos, don't select on Shabbos, don't build on Shabbos, etc., etc. So that's all very interesting. It's all very unusual, right? To have such a disconnect that the Torah Shebichsav is just telling us don't do malacha, not identifying it, not spelling it out, not going into detail, and then leaving Chazal with a very heavy lifting here, right? Talking about the malacha sotza, lifting a piano from one to the other. So here Chazal have this huge job of telling us what exactly these malachas are. Where are they coming from? We have to fight figuring out what exactly is the derivation. So there's a lot to try to understand about why we have the transmission in this way. Why is it that the Torah is teaching us about Shabbos in such a fashion? So that's one question to keep in mind. We're probably not going to be able to answer it at all until tomorrow, but because we only have a few minutes left, but I'll just introduce another issue and we'll continue with both points tomorrow, and then show how they connect into Hotzah. There is a major discussion in the later Svarim as to what exactly the Torah has in mind when it prohibits Malacha and Shabbos. What is it that the Torah wants from us? Is it that there's something bad about Malacha happening? That the world should be at rest on Shabbos? That's really what the Torah wants. Torah wants there to be no malachas taking place, and therefore it is our responsibility as Jews to not have malachas happen, and to not cooperate in any malachas, and to not have any connection to any malachas occurring on Shabbos? Or is it not really that so much? Maybe we don't care so much if there are malachas going on. The Torah just cares that we should not do malachas, that Jewish people should not be physically involved in doing malachas. We should be at rest. But we're not so concerned about malachas happening. You hear the question? It's a little bit of an abstract question, but it's an issue that the Achronim discussed at length. And it has a lot of practical application to it, but it has a thematic application as well. That it could be that the language of the Torah, we just read the Aseret HaDibros, in Parshas Veschanan, I don't have the Chumash on the desk, but should have one nearby. But if you look at the Aseret HaDibros as it's related in Parshas Veschanan, so the Torah seems to say that the goal of Shabbos is Laman Yanuach, that all of your household should be at rest, just like you yourself. So many point to that pasuk and say that this is the nature of the Issa Malacha, that we should not be doing malachas on Shabbos. But malachas that happen are not really our concern. And even if we are responsible for malacha, but we're not the ones doing it, that's not going to be a violation of Hilchos Shabbos on a level min ha-Torah. Now, it's still going to be Isurim Derabbanan that are relevant. But as far as the Torah is concerned, the Torah just prohibits us doing malachas. So, for example, what prompted this whole discussion of the later Svarim is the following issue. We have an Isser on Shabbos called Amir al-Akam. We are not permitted to ask a non-Jew to do malacha for us on Shabbos. However, that Isser is an Isser d'Rabbanan. That's how we generally assume. So the question comes up, why is it only an Isser d'Rabbanan? Why don't we assume that it's also in our Torah? Right, we have a mechanism of shlichus in the Torah. Right, we have a concept that if I ask somebody to do something on my behalf, that very often traces back to me. It's my responsibility. So if I'm not allowed to write something down on Shabbos, or I'm not allowed to cook. So how come from a Torah perspective, Midrabbanan is different, but from a Torah perspective, I'm allowed to ask a non-Jew to cook for me or to write for me? If the Torah doesn't want writing or cooking happening, how come I'm allowed to ask someone else to do it?
A goyish, yeah.
So that's maybe an answer that there are some who say, well, because shlichus wouldn't work, maybe for two other reasons. One reason is we generally say that the concept of shlichus as a chiddush of halacha is limited to Jews, so therefore he wouldn't be an effective shliach. And secondly, we also have a concept, that's also first parak of Mitzvah Sugya, of ein shliach l'dvar aveira, that generally if you're doing an aveira, shlichus usually doesn't trace back to you. So those are two good possibilities, but neither of them necessarily close the book, because first of all, Inshlich Dvar Veira is a subjective machlokas, what exactly it means. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have no liability at all if you ask somebody to do an Aveira for you. And especially on a moral level, if there's something wrong with cooking happening on Shabbos, technicalities aside, if you're having somebody do it for you, that should also violate the Torah's intent. And in terms of the non-Jew, Inshlichus La'akum, so many assume that l'chumra there is shlichus l'akam, that you can't fulfill a mitzvah, l'kula, you can't accomplish something through shlichus by a non-Jew, but as far as a liability, it does exist. So many aren't satisfied with those two possible answers. And again, on a moral level, we understand that if the Torah doesn't want us cooking on Shabbos, the Torah doesn't want us writing on Shabbos, why should it be okay on a Torah level? Again, you have to differentiate between the Din D'Oraisa and the Din D'Rabbanan. But why should it be okay on a Torah level to have somebody else do it for you? So, based on that question, many, many Achronim developed a principle that they said that Shabbos is not about the act itself. It's not about the consequences. God is not interested in having no bishul or ksiva or borer taking place on Shabbos. God is interested that Jews should be at rest, and they should not themselves be doing these malachas. But if they provoke the malacha somehow, that does not violate the Torah's intent. It violates various drabanans. Again, don't walk out of here thinking it's mutter, but it doesn't contradict what the Torah said when it said that Jews should not do malacha on Shabbos. And in fact, some pointed out, Rabbi Yosef Engel, who was a great gaon from the previous century, so he suggested that he himself was not a big fan of this theory we just said. But he said, if you like that theory, then that could explain the phrasing of the Mishnah and Ayin Gimel. That if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos, and we'll stop in a second, the Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos, when he lists the malachos, he uses a different language than the Mishnah and Ayin Gimel. And the Mishnah says, Hazareya, Hachoresh, Hakotzer. And when the Rambam lists malachos, he lists them as actions. It says, Harisha, Zriya, Ketzira, etc., etc. While the Mishnah talks about a person who's doing them, Hazareya, Hachoresh. So Rav Yosef Engel suggested that maybe the Mishnah is addressing this point. The Mishnah is saying that the Torah doesn't care so much about Zriya, Harisha, Ketzira. It cares about Hazareya, Hachoresh, Hakotzer. If you, a Jewish person, is a planter, is a baker, is a writer, is a carrier on Shabbos, that's a concern. That there should be carrying and baking and cooking, that's not our concern. Alex?
That being the case, then what's the function of the Yisur D'Rabbanan?
Very good question. So all of that is an important question, and there's a lot more to say about this. So God, we're already a little bit over time, so God willing, tomorrow we'll have more time, hopefully, to look at the Maamar Kamus about Hotzah, and then we'll try to take this point a little bit further to understand what exactly is the nature of Yisur Malacha, and how does Hotzah either fit into this or not fit into this. God